How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast. A Synopsis. The first talk at Gutenberg College's 2013 Summer Institute, How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast, was presented by Jack Crabtree on July 31, 2013. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
I'm assuming that you all got the paper and have read the paper, but if you haven't, this will serve as a kind of orientation to what I said in the paper, and for those of you who did read the paper, perhaps I'll have some clarifying comments that I can make. The paper comes in three parts with an introduction. In the introduction, I basically assert that American society is in a state of unprecedented hostility to what I call the good. And I define, I think maybe in a footnote, exactly what I mean by the good. And what I mean by the good is things pertaining to God, Jesus, the Bible, biblical truth, this a whole cluster of ideas and a whole cluster of things that largely center on the Bible. I mean, what we who are Bible-believing followers of Jesus, what we're committed to is that our information about God and Jesus and the world comes from the Bible. So most everything I say in the paper is bibliocentric. It's focused on the Bible as the truth that we live our lives by. And therefore, what I'm arguing is that we are in an unprecedented state in American culture in its opposition to biblical truth, or what I call the good. Now, the key, and I perhaps could have emphasized this more than I did in the paper, is that it's an unprecedented state. I mean, I'm not so naive to think that America has ever been committed to the Bible. Of course not. I mean, from the very beginning, the road to eternal life is exceedingly narrow, and few will follow it. The actual authentic existential commitment to the truth of the Bible and to Jesus, our Lord, that the Bible calls for is very rare indeed. It always has been rare. It always will be rare. And I understand that. But to what extent has the truth that is taught by the Bible become a part of the intellectual and spiritual culture such that it is plausible to believe it? I think we are at an unprecedented stage of American history where it has become increasingly less plausible, and we've now reached a point where all the momentum is in the other direction. It's become morally and intellectually impossible to commit our lives to Jesus unless somehow we can overcome the obstacle that's been put in our place by our own culture, the media, the government. Everything about the structure of our society is against that which we are supposed to make a commitment to. Well, I think that's unprecedented. That's what I'm arguing. Now, I can't prove that, as I say in the paper. I can't prove that that's the case. That's simply my reading of a whole cluster of evidence and trying to put together the picture that emerges from that whole cluster of evidence. Am I right? I think so. But I'm not a prophet. I'm not pretending to be a prophet. I don't have the authority of a prophet. I don't presume to know that I'm right. I'm simply, as someone who is a serious student of the Bible, and I think a marginally decent reader of American culture and American society, that the conclusion I've reached is we really are at this unprecedented level of hostility to the good. I list several things that make up the kind of evidence I'm looking at, and if you have some questions about that, we can pursue that. I won't go into that here. Then in part one, I give an analysis of what I call the beast Now, the beast is I'm taking the concept of the beast from the book of Revelation. As I understand what's going on in the book of Revelation, the beast is first and foremost a metaphor for people, cultures, institutions, things in history that are arrayed against the good, against God and the purposes of God. Throughout the Old Testament prophets, and then as picked up by the book of Revelation, the beast is a picture of the ways in which cultures, kings, societies have been moved somehow by Satan. There may very well be a supernatural cause to it. My thesis doesn't depend on that, but the Bible seems to say Satan has something to do with it, where Satan has inspired kings and people groups to come up to destroy the people of God and therefore destroy the purposes of God. It happens in Babylon. It happens with the Persians, the Medes, the Greeks, the Egyptian Ptolemaic kings, the Seleucid kings, and Rome. All of those people, all of those groups and those kings came against Jerusalem to destroy God's people, to put them under their thumbs, and basically thwart God's purposes. That's the beast. Now, Revelation seems to think that there's yet one more head of that beast to come, by my reading of it, it is still in our future. Now, I don't think America is a head of that beast in Revelation. I don't think we even show up in Revelation. But so I'm not arguing that we are in the prophecy of the Old Testament or in Revelation, but I do think that there are other ways in which institutions and people and cultures can be opposed to God and his purposes in a way analogous to what Revelation is talking about. So when I talk about the beast of American culture, I'm not talking about something in Revelation, but I am talking about something that I think is analogous to what you find in Revelation. One thing I wish I had made clear in the paper, and I didn't, is I'm talking about something more than human evil and human sinfulness. I mean, we could certainly, with great profit, talk about the beast that is manifest throughout all of human experience, in me, in you, in all of us. And we could, with great profit, speak to that. In one of the papers that I will read, Earl Craig's paper, that's what he does. But I think that's fully legitimate, and there's certainly no problem with that. But I do want to make a distinction between what he's doing with the concept of the beast and what I'm doing with the concept of the beast in my paper. By the concept of the beast, I'm talking about something that takes on a life of its own, that transcends all of us as individuals. It plays back on our lives and oppresses us, seduces us, sucks us in, directs us, governs us, controls us. And what makes it the beast is not just plain old ordinary vanilla depravity. What makes it the beast is this interplay of dynamics that gives it a power over our lives that actually shapes history. And I think that's where the satanic dimension comes in. It's Satan trying to thwart the purposes of God. There's a kind of purpose to it. There's a kind of direction to it. There's a kind of rationality to it. Human depravity would be chaos left to itself. What orchestrates all this depravity and channels all this depravity in such a way to effectively undermine the truth? That's what I'm calling the beast. And that as I say, ultimately, it may be that the only explanation for it is Satan himself. Well, I try to analyze, from my perspective, the dynamics that I think make it so powerful. How does it work in American culture? How does it shape us? How does it mold us? Why do we think the way we think? Why are we tempted in the way that we're tempted? Why are we coerced in the way that we're coerced? I think that it's the dynamic interplay of basically three things. One is this incredible perception that we have all somehow absorbed that there exists a superior class of people in America. That's the first one. The second one is that there exists an orthodox religion of this superior class, and I labeled it to begin with, contra-biblicism to capture what I think constitutes this set of beliefs and values. And then finally, there's the phenomenon of propaganda at work in us and among us to reinforce our commitment, our religious commitment to the Orthodox religion of contra-biblicism. And let me talk about each of those things a little bit. Unlike older Europe, where you're born wealthy or noble, you're born into a certain class, from the very beginning, America has been highly democratic in a way that has been is uncanny in human history. And to get a feel for that, read de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. But there's this uncanny kind of sense of democracy, that nobody is better than anybody else. We're all the same. We're all equal. The superior class in America, therefore, is highly democratic. Anyone and everyone can belong, no matter what your genealogy, no matter how wealthy you are. Anyone and everyone can belong. All you have to do is meet the qualifications. And the only thing you need to do to meet the qualifications is believe in the Orthodox religion of the superior class, to become a fellow co-religionist with the other superior class will make you a member of this superior class. So all you have to do is change the way you think, change what you value, conform, and that conformity will qualify you. Now, you're not going to get a certificate. You're not going to get a degree. You're not going to get a card. You're not going to get any sort of recognition from other people telling you you belong to the superior class. You are self-appointed. It is a self-assessed reality. I can ask myself the question, do I belong to the superior class? Yes, I do. And on what basis am I going to self-assess myself to be a member of the superior class? I will do so simply because I have resolved within myself to abide by the values and beliefs and tenets of the religion of the superior class. And as long as I'm satisfied that I do that, I am given the privilege to count myself among the members of the superior class. Why would I want to do that? What's the point? The point is there's incredible personal rewards that come from belonging to the superior class. I can think of myself as intellectually superior, as morally superior, or as socially superior, or all three of those things, any combination of those things, whatever I'm most interested in being superior in, it's available to me to think of myself as superior in that way. I point out that in that section, or maybe it's not in that section, but I point out somewhere that it's an uncanny reality, this superior class. I have felt the pressure of this my whole life, and I could never quite figure out what's behind it. Where is this coming from? But growing up in a very conservative, Bible-believing culture and background, I always had a sense that I was on the margins of American society. I was always on the out. I was always the hick, the dumb guy, the idiot, who believe these things that no really intellectually superior person would ever actually believe or ever actually think. And all my life I've been caught between my understanding. I was sophisticated enough to know that I wasn't supposed to believe in Jesus. On the one hand, everything in my culture was telling me that. On the other hand, I couldn't shake the reality that Jesus really was who he said he was, and I'd be a fool to reject him. So I was always caught between those. By the grace of God, I always chose to be a follower of Jesus and rather than give in. But I always knew that I was making a choice to put myself in an inferior class of people in American society. Now, where on earth did that come from? Because that stays with me to this day. I know that if I were to go over to the philosophy department at the University of Oregon and give a lecture or speak in front of all the other professors there, I know what they're thinking of me. I know how they view me. Now, I'm old now. I've thought about a lot of things. I am not an unthinking, unintelligent, uneducated, unstudied person. I have confronted the issues. I've confronted the objections. I've confronted the arguments, and I still believe in Jesus. I think it's the truth. I'm convinced that it's the truth. That is not a shallow, casual belief that I have that I inherited from my parents. I have made it my own. Intellectually, I have nothing to be ashamed of, and I know that. But I would be intimidated as hell to step in front of the philosophy department and tell them what I think. Because I know exactly the things that are going through their mind. And you do too, I think. That's the power and dynamic of the superior class. Well, it wields a power that is much greater than the actual numbers of people who believe what they believe. And I point out the phenomenon in the early part of the 20th century that has always been a little weird to me, and I could never quite figure it out. At the end of the 19th century, you have this collision between what's called modernism and fundamentalism. Modernist Christianity was the Christianity that was molded and shaped by the theologians and biblical scholars in the German universities, highly influenced by Hegel, then eventually by Marx. But it really wasn't Christianity. It was just this synchronized religion that went by the name of Christianity. Well, that got imported, exported. We Americans imported that in the 1800s, and it began to really make significant inroads into the universities in America and seminaries. Well, there was a reaction to that by the so-called fundamentalists. Within not that many years, fundamentalism adopted the strategy of basically deciding we can't win this battle, we can't win this war, and they withdrew. And a lot of historians of Christianity have looked at them and criticized them for what they call their fortress mentality, that they just withdrew. The evangelicalism emerged later in the 20th century as a reaction to that, and what they were reacting to is the fundamentalists should never have done that. They shouldn't have withdrawn. They shouldn't have tried to create a counterculture or a subculture. They should have stayed in the academy. They should have remained as professors in the universities and duked it out with modernism there. Now, whether the evangelicals were right about that or not, that's a question that only history can ultimately answer. But I understand what the fundamentalists were thinking. The fundamentalists were looking at the momentum of their culture, and they were saying, this is not going in the direction of the Bible and the truth. It just ain't. That's not where it's headed. And my contention in the paper is they were not wrong about that. They were right about that. American culture has not gone in the direction of the Bible and Jesus and Christianity and truth. You know, I lived through, and in a way, I'm a product of the so-called Jesus movement. That lasted 18 months. It was a little blip coming out of nowhere and quickly fading away and getting drowned out by the momentum, the groundswell, the hurricane force of American culture going toward in the direction the beast wanted to take it, to ungodliness, to an abandoning of truth, to it not only an abandoning of truth, a hostility and an antagonism toward the truth. Well, the fundamentalists were right. Now, they, and probably I today, didn't have any perspective to know what kind of time frame, how long it was going to take for the forces of modernism to have the corrosive effects that they were ultimately going to have. They probably thought it was going to happen within a decade. It took longer than that. But just because it took longer than that didn't mean that they were wrong in their assessment of what the ultimate effects of this were going to be. So I think the fundamentalists were right about that. Okay, in any case, all of this comes from the attraction of the superior class. And the thing that gives it such power is that it offers to each and every one of us the opportunity to have a self-concept of being among the morally, intellectually, and socially superior people in American culture. If you are a Jesus freak, you are a freak, period. And that's what it comes down to. The second dynamic that I explore is this Orthodox religion of the superior class, and it's what I call contra-biblicism. It's the value system, religion, the system of beliefs of the superior class, and the most important thing to recognize is that it's not a philosophically coherent system of ideas and values. There's nothing really coherent about it. And the reason it's not coherent is because it doesn't start from a set of observations and conclusions and assumptions about reality and then infer a whole system of ideas following from that and coming out of that. That's not how it's put together. It's actually a selective hodgepodge of the Bible teaches that, I reject that. The Bible teaches this, I reject that. The Bible teaches this other, I reject that too. Now I've got all these rejected values and beliefs. I put them in the same pot and say, you believe that and you honor that as well. Well, why should I do that? Because they're in the pot. Well, give me an argument. Argument, they're in the pot. It's part of our religion. It's part of what we value. Any cultural critique of the social left in this country has just absolutely blown their minds trying to make sense out of it. It is absolutely immoral to club a little baby seal to death. It is absolutely immoral to stop people from clubbing a human baby to death. How do you put that together? Where is the coherence of that? And my contention would be there is no coherence to that. It makes absolutely no sense at all. But it's not supposed to make sense because it's not derived philosophically from a set of insights and observations and beliefs and axioms. It's just, its only coherence, if you will, is that if the Bible teaches it, I'm against it with certain qualifications. Now, because it is not a philosophically coherent perspective, we're all human beings. And as human beings, we know good and well that my beliefs should be intellectually responsible. I shouldn't commit to something that I know is irrational and contradictory and incoherent. I mean, why would I do that? I'm a reasonable person, right? At least I need to believe that I'm a reasonable person. I need to believe that I'm being intellectually responsible. So I need to believe that this hodgepodge of incoherent fragments of beliefs that I am obliged to hold, I have to believe that I'm warranted in believing them. So two things happen. I make a religious commitment to them, and I make a distinction between a religious commitment and an intellectual commitment. And on the side, I hope this was clear in the paper, we as followers of Jesus have no business whatsoever making a religious commitment to Jesus. That is irresponsible, it is immoral, it is anti-biblical. There's no reason in the world why we should make a religious commitment. Our commitment is an intellectual commitment. And here's the distinction I'm making. A religious commitment is, I'm going to believe this, and nobody's going to stop me, no matter what. No matter what the evidence is, no matter what the arguments are, no matter what the truth is, I'm going to believe in Jesus. That's a religious commitment. An intellectual commitment is, I think this is true. The evidence is there. The arguments for it are sound. I have every reason to think. My mind has every reason to think that all the evidence points to this being true, and that's why I'm committed to it. Now, if I find the arguments fallacious, or if I find that there's contrary evidence, if I find some reason why I should no longer think that's true, then I need to withdraw my commitment, because why would I believe something that I suspect strongly is not true? That's the kind of belief that we should have in Christianity, the Bible, and in Jesus. If the arguments are not there, if the evidence is not there, if the truth is not there, why on earth would I be a Christian if it's not true? But a religious commitment says, I'm here, I'm planting both feet here, and nobody's going to move me no matter what. No reasons in the world can budge me. Well, what contra-biblicism ultimately requires is a religious commitment to its tenets and values and beliefs. Why? You can't make an intellectual commitment to something that's philosophically incoherent, contradictory, and inconsistent. Not for very long. So you have to end up making a religious commitment to it. But all of us, if we have an ounce of humanity in us, we get uncomfortable with a religious commitment. Why would I believe something that all the evidence points to is probably not true? Why would I do that? Well, we have to somehow satisfy ourselves that I'm warranted in believing it's true in order to continue and maintain that kind of religious commitment. And that's where propaganda plays such a critical role. The way I'm defining propaganda is propaganda is some kind of specious argument, a fact that's not a fact, an evidence that is no evidence, something that can be offered me that I can sell to you, some other American in American society, that I can offer it to you that sends the signal to you, I believe this and I am rationally warranted in believing this. Now, what I offer you doesn't actually have to be real, genuine warrant. I hope you understand what I'm saying by that. It doesn't actually have to be philosophically sound that I'm justified in believing this belief because of what I just said to you. It doesn't really matter whether what I said to you actually justifies what I just said. What matters is that you think I think it does. That's all that matters. And there's a whole industry out there that supplies to us slogans, bumper stickers, talking points, various statements that we can make, and it tells us, you know, when anyone challenges you on this belief or on this judgment or this decision, just say this. This will work. I really started thinking along these lines when I was noticing that I would listen to the television Tuesday night and be in a conversation Wednesday morning, and the very thing that came out of the talking head, I mean verbatim, from the talking head Tuesday night is what God offered up to me as a reason for believing what they believed on Wednesday morning. And it just didn't happen just once. It happened over and over and over and over again. And I finally, it took me a while, I have a thick skull, but I finally realized I get how this works. I get my reasons for what I believe from them. And I never really stopped to think about whether what they said makes any sense. That doesn't really matter. It worked last night on television, so surely it will work this morning with my neighbor. That's propaganda. And it's absolutely critical. And we crave propaganda if we have religious commitments. And I spent most of my time giving an example out of Christian culture, that we do exactly the same thing in Christian culture. We don't honor objections and questions. We don't take them seriously. We have whole seminars that we offer to our young people. Come to this seminar in the Rocky Mountains somewhere, and we will give you 20 reasons why you shouldn't be a socialist and 15 reasons why you shouldn't be a Marxist and 15 reasons why whatever else. And they're just talking points. It's just propaganda. We don't actually stop to think about and analyze why this should make any sense. We're just giving ammunition. And the ammunition is primarily for me. It's not really to convince anybody else. I don't care whether I convince you. At least I don't care whether I convince you of the point of view. What I do want to convince you of is that I know what I'm talking about. And I'm being intellectually respectable to believe what I believe. That's the role, I think, of propaganda. Okay, then I have a section where I changed the label or the title of contrabiblicism. Contrabiblicism is the best title, the most apt title, because I think it captures the essence of that religion. But leftism is more historically familiar because, as a matter of historical accident, contrabiblicism has embraced the social and political and economic left as its beliefs of choice. It didn't have to be that way, I would maintain. It would be theoretically possible for contrabiblicism to have taken a kind of a right turn instead of a left turn. So there's nothing logically necessary or inherent in contra-biblicism that required it to embrace the left. But as a matter of fact, in our history, that's exactly what happened. I mean, you show me someone who has the economic and political values of the left, and I'll show you someone who's not committed to sexual purity, for example. Why? Why would does that follow? Why would that have to be? Because the orthodoxy of the superior class that dictates the values puts sexual immorality, from a biblical perspective, together with commitment to the kinds of ideals that you find in the political and economic left. So I call it leftism as a matter of historical fact, I think. And then I discuss the various kinds of reactions from the right that America has produced to this thing that I call leftism. And the most important point, I won't go over all of those. Hopefully you've had a chance to read that. But the most important point in all of that is that not all right-wing people are on the right. And when I define the right as I do, as committed to the values of the Bible and the truth in the Bible, that's what I mean by the right. That most people that get classified as right-wing in our culture are not right-wing at all in that sense. Republican Party is just as much a enemy of the gospel of Jesus Christ as is the Democratic Party. I don't think there's any question about that. The libertarians are not on the right for the most part. They're just a different faction of the left. Political conservatives, most of them are really actually different factions of the left. They're not on the right. And then you have all the other categories are genuinely on the right, but there's only one of them that I'm recommending, and that is the response of what I call the radical biblicist. To be on the right just to be defending the traditions and history and religion of American culture, that's really not good enough, and it's not really defending the right thing. If we want to defend the truth, then we need to be committed to the truth. And only radical biblicism is actually committed to the truth, per se. Okay, then that's part one. Then in part two, I give five options I'm asking the question then, as a follower of Jesus in the present circumstances, what am I obligated to do by my obedience to Jesus? And I give five options that I explore. One option is that we just live personal lives that are exemplary. God will use our lives to save America. That's one possibility. And you'll have all kinds of Christians advocating that. Another one would be that we need to work in the cultural institutions of America to save America. We need to reform our institutions, churches, community groups of various kinds. And we'll save America that way. The third one is that we work in the political structures to save America. So we get out the vote to vote for candidates who are going to take us back in the direction of respect for the truth of the Bible, and America will be saved by that. Fourth possibility, which sounds a little extreme, but it is a possibility, is to prepare to act militarily to save America. And God will use our efforts to save America. The fifth one is that we live personal lives that are exemplary, but God has no intention of saving America. America's going down. And my job, my obedience to Jesus, simply requires me to live as an obedient servant of Jesus, but I no longer live with any illusions that my doing so is going to save our country and save our culture. Those seem to be the five options. I argue that it boils down to this. We are in a situation today, I think, let me put it this way. The question boils down to this. I answer that question by asking, are we in the kind of situation that the Americans in the colonies, in colonial America, were in? Or are we in the situation that the believers were in ancient Rome? It makes a big difference. Notice what a different response those two groups of believers had to their situation. You don't have any hint from Jesus, from Paul, any of the apostles, any of the early Christians, okay, you guys, we need to get organized. We need to reform this Roman Empire. We need to get it straight. We need to make its institutions more godly. There was no hint that they were even thinking in those terms. Why? That's the question. In colonial America, taking grief from King George, the early Americans, and what's important to me are not just the early Americans, but the actual believers, Bible-believing, true Jesus-following believers in the American colonies, it would appear to me that some of them were active participants in the cultural, political, and military opposition to King George. Now, why do you have two sets of believers responding so differently to their situation? The only thing that makes sense to me is that they assessed their situation in history differently. They assessed what God was going to do, what God was up to, what God was doing. They assessed that differently. The Romans, the Roman believers, the believers in Rome, apparently did not conclude, oh, I get it. Now that King Jesus has come, he's going to kick Roman butt and knock the emperor off his throne, and we're going to have a Christian kingdom. So let's get on with it. Let's do it. Where's your sword? That's not the way they responded, because I think they realized God had no intention in the near future, in their lifetime, of bringing Rome down. So what's a Christian to do? Live under the thumb of the beast. All you can do is live your lives at peace with all men as far as is possible for you, and live obediently to your Lord, and let God take care of history. He's not going to use you to change history right now. That, I think, is what they were concluding. Not so the colonists. They saw all the momentum blowing in the direction of giving them the opportunity to break loose from England and the moral decadence that they perceived was there, and perhaps to build for themselves a society, a culture, a nation, a situation where faith could thrive. And because they believed that, and believed that that's what God willed, that's what God was doing, they were willing to take up arms, to write tracts, to write pamphlets, to make speeches, and engage socially and politically to change their culture. So the question is, which one are we in? Are we like colonial America, or are we like the believers in Rome? Well, that's a judgment call. I mean, some of you may evaluate that very, very differently than I do. But my perception is we're in the twilight of this American experience. All the momentum is in the other direction, and that what we face is life under the thumb of the beast. That I don't see any other realistic option. Certainly in the near future, I think that's inevitable, but that has to be the case. If God is going to change history, he's going to change it with another completely out of the blue, unexpected reformation, spiritual reformation, that I don't see on the horizon. And I don't see any evidence that that's on its way. But I might be totally wrong with that. But for our lives, the important thing is whether that reformation is even on the horizon. Because even if centuries from now there's another reformation, that's not going to affect us. That's in God's hands, in the way he shapes history. But for us, we have to face into the reality. For me, my children, my grandchildren, I need to face into the reality that they're going to be living under the thumb of a beast. Then in part three, I say, and from my perspective, this is a very inadequate section. I mean, obviously, I don't know what to do, but I make a few comments and a few remarks about where I think this leaves us. What should we do? Well, I think our priorities have to shift, and maybe this is my age here, but there was a time in my 20s and 30s where I thought we could change America. If I simply lived in obedience to my Creator and could persuade as many other people as possible to live in obedience to the Creator, we would literally transform American culture. And that was very much consciously a part of my intention and my purpose. My goal is to take part in that reformation by doing my part in my individual life to bring that about. What I'm saying here, what I'm announcing in this paper, is I've changed my mind about that being a realistic expectation. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't care how obedient we are, we're not going to change America. History is going in a different direction. So my priority has to shift off of saving America, if that's where it has been, and on to saving myself and my neighbor. I can reach out to my neighbor and snatch my neighbor out of the jaws of death by inviting them to believe in and hope in the same good news that I believe in and hope in. I can do that, but I should have no illusions that I'm going to change the culture by doing that. And then I make some practical suggestions about steps we can take. I think we need to make our commitment to Jesus everything. I mean, everything I say here should be true at any time in history anyway. I mean, this is just flat-out biblical stuff, but this should be our lives. But, you know, when the darkness is falling, when the judgment is coming, just like the prophet said, you know, the Babylonians are coming, now is the time to repent. Well, when we see the judgment coming down on us, it is all the more important that we take seriously what the Bible is telling every human being for all time anyway. Namely, make our commitment to Jesus everything. Uncompromised, unmitigated by other allegiances. So we should rid our lives of other allegiances, whatever they might be. We should resolve to fear God and not man. I mean, what gives the beast his power is my desire to look respectable in your eyes. If I don't give a damn what you think, that gives me power to be obedient to Jesus. But as long as I think what you think matters and counts, then the beast has power over me. So I need to fear God and not man. And then I spend most time here arguing that we need to anchor our lives in the Bible, in interpreting the Bible as someone who's radically committed to what the Bible says, not what Christian culture says, not what Christian tradition says, not what Christian orthodoxy says, but what the Bible actually says. Because that and only that will anchor us in the truth that will fortify us against the lies. And I need to become practiced in discerning the lies of the beast. And I think we have ample opportunity for practice in the world that we exist in today. I think we're going to have to, there are some necessary changes that are going to have to occur in our expectations and in our relationships. I don't think we can any longer expect evangelism to be fruitful. For those of you who are as old as I am, will remember the slogan of Campus Crusade for Christ back in the 1960s, winning the world for Christ. And I honestly think they were utterly sincere in believing that that was a possibility. That if we just told them the gospel straight and just told it to them right, they would all believe and that they would all become Christians. Now, the irony is they were very successful. The Jesus movement didn't come out of nowhere. The Jesus movement was the result of Christians actively taking the gospel into our culture, and they got a certain significant positive response to that. But I don't think we can expect another Jesus movement. We don't live in that America any longer. We live in a different America. So I don't think we can expect evangelism to be fruitful. I don't think we can expect to be as materially prosperous as we've been in the past. I go back to the book of James. What was James writing into? A situation where believers, because they were believers, were exploited economically. I think we can count on that eventually coming to be. 10 years, 15 years, that's what I would guess, but it's probably 1,500 years, but it's coming. You know, it's a significant outcome of where we are today. I think we should expect society to be more dangerous, and we should expect people to be more dangerous. I've always been struck by that passage in John, where the very first trip that Jesus takes to Jerusalem, he begins to perform many miracles, and the people are dazzled by it. I mean, they're really impressed by it and are beginning to gather around him. And John makes this comment, but Jesus did not entrust himself to any man, for he knew man's heart, and he didn't need anyone to teach him about man's heart. He knew what man was made of, so he didn't entrust himself to them. Well, we could afford to be relatively naive in American culture over the last several decades. People are decent. People are tolerant. People are respectful. People have a memory of it being okay to believe in Jesus. And we could afford to be relatively naive. But we can expect in the future that our friends are going to become a Judas to us. They will betray us. Because that's always what's in man's heart anyway. We are by nature Judases. They are and we are. I think we'll have to learn to fly under the radar of government scrutiny. So evangelism will have to become private and selective. Contrast Billy Graham of the 1950s with Tim Tebow of the early 2000s. Tim Tebow was just trying in his own way to announce to the world, I am committed to Jesus. I believe in Jesus. Billy Graham could say that in the 1950s, get whole cities to come out and listen to him and have nothing but respect in the media. What does Tim Tebow do? Much less than Billy Graham ever did. And he gets crucified for it by the media, by the sportscasters, by the public, and everything else. I think we need to learn our lesson. Tim Tebow is naive about the culture he lives in today. That's not the way to evangelize. The way to evangelize, I think, will be to simply, as someone comes and asks about the hope that is in me, tell them. But no more propagandizing, no more trying to prepare the way and create opportunities for myself, because they are not there to be created, I think. Then I think we must build different kinds of communities. Churches aren't going to cut it any longer. So I think we need to build different kinds of communities that are no longer in league and sanctioned by the government, but they are anchored in the Bible and are radically biblical in their nature. I think we need to think Christians in China, not Christians in 1950s America. We must create new approaches and practices with regard to education. I think education is going to be the key. Education is what got us into this mess. And if anything could possibly get us out of this mess, if there is going to be a reformation, it's going to be through a complete reinvigoration and reformation of our educational system. Stop propagandizing people. Stop baptizing them into the state religion and actually educate them so that they can think and think critically and think carefully. Now, is that going to make it happen? No. It's going to have to be the Spirit of God transforming people's hearts. But the only thing concretely that we could do to prepare the soil for that is to offer real education to people. We don't have a lot of time, but in the little time that remains, do you want to ask a question of clarification or make a comment?
I had a question about the superior class, the phenomenon of that. 1 week or two ago, Mr. Obama made a speech. It was right after the Trayvon Martin thing came out and everybody was demonstrating and that kind of thing. And I'm not super a fan of Mr. Obama, but when my dad and I watched him speak, it occurred to me that what he was trying to do was to get both sides, white people who were in favor of the Zimmerman verdict and black people who thought it was a travesty of justice, to see where the other side was coming from. And so he made the point that being a black man is not always easy. He talked about, you know, hearing people lock their car doors when they saw him, and people changed to the other side of the street, and being shopping when he was a young man and being followed by security just because he was a black man. And then he spent much less time talking about what things look like from the perspective of the white people who were sympathetic to Zimmerman's situation. And very quickly, he made reference to the idea that young black men were disproportionately represented in violent crime. And his point seemed to be, although he didn't spend a lot of time belaboring it, that for white people to see a young black man and to be afraid, statistically made some sense because of the how much violent crime is committed by young black men. So in the discussion, and then he didn't say anything more, in the discussion about what he had talked about, the people who you would expect to be Obama fans, just went on and on and on about the black experience and how he talked about the black experience and that kind of thing. Not one mention of his acknowledging that young black men were disproportionately represented in violent crime. Even on the Fox News conservative TV, there wasn't much mention of that, which when my dad and I, both of us pretty politically conservative, watched the speech, when he said what he said, we looked at each other and went, whoa, never thought he'd ever acknowledge that. I mean, that's basically a justification for profiling. And so I felt a whole lot better about him at the time, but nobody, none of his, the people who are his fans, mentioned that he said this very controversial, not cool thing. And I was just wondering if in your idea of the superior class, if there are some people who are acknowledged to be in the superior class and they say something that's uncool, one thing that could happen is that if they're held in enough esteem, then they might change the direction the religion is going. And another thing could be people just don't even hear it because it's not part of our mantra. And I was just wondering if you could comment about that, the ability or lack of it for people who are highly placed in the echelon of the superior class to themselves make a difference.
To what'd you say? To
themselves to make a difference. Or I thought it was actually pretty brave of him to say this, because he'd have to know that if anybody took him seriously, it would go over like a lead balloon. He was going to lose some people. But he said it anyway, which I appreciated. But it was totally ignored.
Mm-hmm. So you want me to comment on what exactly?
What's going on there when you've got somebody who's sort of a mover and a shaker in the superior class, someone who in theory could come out and say something that was contrary to the dogma, the orthodoxy mm-hmm. of the religion of the superior class, and they say it, and I guess maybe it's an example of how this thing can have a life of its own.
Two comments. One is that I don't think anyone can steer the superior class to tenets and beliefs and values that they don't want to embrace. I mean, there is something kind of almost populist about the superior class. It's going the direction that sinful man wants to go, and one individual only has a certain amount of limited power to steer that, I would think. My second comment is that Obama is in a very, very unique situation in two respects. One is he is a touchstone to the superior class at the moment. I mean, anything he says is okay, just because he has become sort of an icon of the superior class, so he can get away with it. Secondly, have you read The Audacity of Hope? It's very interesting. His rhetorical style is to come along, take an issue, and he parrots both sides, the best of both sides of the issue. But as I've noticed over the last several years, it really doesn't matter how balanced and even-handed his rhetoric is. He governs on the left. And I think everybody knows that it doesn't really matter what he says. He's a superior class contrabiblicist. He's securely in the camp. Doesn't really matter what he says.
So they ignore if he says something that seems to go in another direction.
Yeah.
I've noticed when you describe contrabiblicism, you describe it as an orthodoxy. Is there any particular reason for that?
Well, what makes an orthodoxy is it's a set of beliefs or values or tenets that you are required to believe if you want to be one of us. I mean, it's defining the inside of a group from everybody on the outside. Anyone who doesn't believe that's a heretic. Anyone who doesn't believe that is on the outside. So there are many orthodoxies in the world, and the superior class contrabiblicism has its own orthodoxy.
It seems that the most significant difference between the beast that is described in your words and the beast in various other forms in history, specifically in the Old Testament. So we have the beast of the end times, the beast that moves against the great righteous civilization. The irony of that beast is that as that beast moves against the righteous civilization that God sets up in the book of Revelations, he's actually doing so that God can bring the wicked low. That's right. The great irony of the beast, is that right. That it's this sort of hubris that moves against what is good and what God has established good on this earth. And in that instance, God uses the beast to decimate the wicked in the final moments of history.
Right.
That seems like the only time the beast is used that way. In the Old Testament, the beast is used very purposefully. When you describe the invading pagan hordes, they were always sent to teach the righteous a lesson there. Do you understand what I mean?
Well, was it to teach the righteous a lesson or to chastise an unrighteous people?
Thank you. So, okay. But to chastise a very specific unrighteous people, to chastise those people who are supposed to be adherent greatest to God, who are supposed to be most faithful to God. So, again, Obama, I mean, are we to understand the beast now in that light? Shouldn't we understand that if America has become this other thing, the beast now rolls into America, if there's a finger to point, it's simply it. It's us.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
If there is a party responsible for the rise of the beast, it is us. It is our faithlessness. It is our 40 years of evangelical crapola. So as much as you're really great. I love this school, and I'm so glad your class of 2002 forever. So, but everything you say seems to be so heavily weighed against this fear of the beast. When in reality, I'm more afraid of my own kind. I'm more afraid of the evangelicals I've seen interact in America for the last 30 years. I'm more convinced of their true wickedness than I am of some sort of invading army. Like, me being sold into slavery is not nearly the kind of terror that I'm imagining when someone convinces me that I have made the leap when I haven't. And evangelicals and their political movement and them being in bed with Republicans and them trying to promote an orthodoxy, a moral orthodoxy that was supposed to be a salve to what is ultimately my quest to know God. You don't need faith, you just have to vote a certain way and you're fine. That sort of clubism, I'm kind of excited. Like, I'm kind of excited that the culture war is finally over because I'm glad that the evangelicals have lost. And I'm seeing the rise of the beast as a good thing for us.
Well, yeah, I agree.
Oh, you can just stop there. I'll be good.
Yeah, I think you're right. This is in part a judgment on American Christendom. I don't have any question about that. We have not been faithful. We have not been faithful followers. All that's true. Did I say in the paper I was afraid of slavery? I mean, I am afraid of slavery, so it's possible that he meant. But my main concern in the paper is I'm afraid of unbelief. And as bad as Christendom was, it's not really very attractive. It's not likely to seduce me into unbelief in the way that I think what's coming is. That what I fear is the power, the seductive power of the lies, the deceptions, the myths, the ungodliness that's going to be peddled. It's going to become, as I started my thing, I think it's going to become morally and intellectually impossible to take Jesus seriously. And it'll take a miracle from God in an individual's life to overcome the cultural obstacle that presents. So that's more my real fear than, you know, if I'm poor, I'm poor. If I'm a slave, I'm a slave. If I'm dead, I'm dead. Now, I say that like I can be sanguine about it. I can't, but my attitude should be whatever, you know, that I need to face the future with courage, whatever it might be. So that shouldn't be our fear. Our fear should be that we lose our soul. I mean, how can you disagree with that?
I have a request for clarification, I think,
sure.
But I'm not sure on what. So
okay.
What I'm going to do is give you what I think is a bad response to what you said and hear what you have to say about it.
Okay.
I know what I think you would say and what I would say.
Let's hope I don't think it's a good response.
I don't think that's a worry. You made the comparison to, say, the new believers in the Roman Empire when you were talking about the ways we ought to, I mean, the five suggested ways you have, and I think you say that number one and five basically collapse into the same thing. But so here's a bad response, I think, kind of bad. The new believers in the Roman Empire were disenfranchised from cultural and political realities in a way that we're not. So just by being in the culture I'm in, I find myself in cultural institutions and churches, etc., and I find myself in political institutions, and so seeking to live a life of a personally exemplary life and seeking to reform a cultural institution, for example, seem extensionally, at least in terms of, you know, overt actions, fairly similar. So
I'm sorry, could you back up just two sentences?
Yeah.
That we're connected with all these institutions, take it from there.
So since we're connected in these ways, simply by trying to live a personally, morally exemplary life, that's not going to be different than trying to reform our institutions, insofar as, I mean, this is, I think, probably the presupposition is that institutions are just useful fictions, really they're aggregates of individuals, right? So in trying to save myself and save my neighbors, I'm going to end up seeking to, and in some way, reform the cultural institution. So that would be the kind of, you see the shape of the response there?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And I don't, at least in this transitional phase that I see us in right now, I don't have any problem with us staying connected with those institutions and living lives of obedience to Jesus. I mean, what else should we do? I mean, I think that's an appropriate thing to do. It's mainly a change, a shift in my expectations. I would have done that before expecting that over time I'm going to influence my neighbor and my other neighbor and we're going to influence one another and become more of a dominant flavor to the institution such that we literally do reform the institution. I think what I'm saying is I can't go at it with that expectation and with that as my motive any longer, I think, because we don't live in that day where I don't think that's what God is doing. What God is doing is blinding the minds, blinding the hearts, hardening the hearts, dulling the minds of non-Christians and Christians in American culture in such a way that it's not going to penetrate. They're not even going to respect us for living exemplary lives. They're going to mock us for living exemplary lives. I mean, we already see that. I mean, there's certain icons in our culture that they're hated for no other reason. I think Tim Tebow is an example. They're hated for no other reason than they choose to connect themselves with Jesus. Well, even in our churches, what we're going to find is that hostility, I think, is going to grow. And if you take Jesus and the Bible seriously, you're going to end up becoming a pariah of some kind in that church. So I don't think we need to leave the institutions. I think they're going to kick us out.
So kind of the second prong of the same bad response. So I get some kind of impression, and perhaps this is unfair, that you are, to a certain extent, advocating perhaps a withdrawal from certain kinds of institutions of a sort. And I think at least a lot of people I know would probably argue that we're called to love people in our culture, and that's the basis for why we ought to evangelize, et cetera, and withdrawal is the antithesis of that.
Mm-hmm.
So, I would like to hear.
Yeah, no, that's great. That is a very likely criticism, and I'm withdrawing from the institutions of American culture because I no longer have the expectation that I can help fix them. They're not going to be fixed. Am I withdrawing from my engagement with other people? I don't think so. We shouldn't. I think that would be wrong to do that. But I need to interact with them and interface with them differently than we have in the past. Recognizing how dangerous it is, recognizing how ineffective it's going to be. I mean, with just a certain change, a shift in my expectations, I will go ahead and engage as the opportunity arises. That I think in the past, when people's fear of withdrawal is if you withdraw, you're going to leave people behind. They're going to be people who otherwise would be saved, and you weren't there to tell them. But that's where I think we just need to trust in the sovereignty of God. If God wants to save them, they'll be on my doorstep asking, now, why do you have this hope? And it would be utterly unloving to not care to give them account for the hope that I have. So no, not for a second do I believe that we should abandon other people, because that's our mission, is to bring as many people with us as we can. So I don't, in that sense, we're not withdrawing, but I'm not advocating it. I'm saying I think it's going to just become inevitable that we're going to have to withdraw from the institutions. And like I say, so when I talk about building a counterculture, I think we have the luxury right now of beginning to put that counterculture in place, not because we need to flee to it, but when they kick us out, we need some place to go. So I would build it in parallel with our everyday lives right now.
Thank you.
Could the answer of what I should do, if all of us asked, what should I do, could the answer be different for all of us, not because we disagree, but because God is calling us to different things?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's always true and always will be true, that we as individuals will be called to different kinds of engagement. Yeah, so I think we just need to be obedient to our individual calling, whatever that means. Yeah, good point. Shoot, that was the next to the left.
This actually isn't a question for you as much as for
for Toby, and I'll give you 2 days. I'll give you 2 days to prepare. I don't want you to answer it now. I'll give you the 2 days to give your talk to prepare. I would love to have you. I'm the old white guy that I think is. You've spoken somewhat dismissively of us old white guys in the past. I would love to have you. Love to have you help me truly understand why, out of all there is to fear in the world, evangelicals are at the top of your list. I mean, give that some thought, and maybe you can. That stops me in my seat. That for you, evangelicals are the thing that you fear, as opposed to any number of other things. So give that some thought, and maybe you can address that for us on Saturday.
Okay.